Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
All right, thank you for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. You are listening to a special studio session. I'm your host, Erin Fairbanks, and I'm joined in the studio today by my co-host, Kathleen Cherry.
Hi, how are you doing?
And we are here to talk some New York State wines with Tricia Renshaw of Fox Run Vineyards. Tricia, welcome to the studio.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be part of your show.
Oh, awesome. Well, we won't disappoint. So what brought you to the city? Because you're not normally in these parts.
Not normally in these parts, no. It's a lot of fun to get down, though, and feel all the excitement that's going on down here and be part of the local food movement, especially. I came down to participate in the New York Drinks New York event, which was held at the Astor Center on Monday, a big trade show, and then also a consumer tasting. And then we've been having events throughout the week. We had a dinner last night at Terroir, and tonight we're having a dinner at Seersucker, and there are events all throughout the city.
Awesome. So you'll be pouring your wines at all the events, right?
That's right. That's right.
Awesome. Well, I want to tuck into a little bit more about the wines, but I thought we would get started by hearing a little bit about you. How did you get into the winemaking business?
Well, for me, it was an epiphany. I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life when my kids were going to school. I had all these opportunities. My degree was in French. I really should have gone back to school to become a school teacher. That's the thing that made sense. And somehow I ended up at Fox Run Vineyards visiting for their garlic festival. And as luck would have it, I had to park by the Chardonnay vines, and in order to get into my car at the end of the festival, I had to step into the vineyard. And I looked around, and somehow I said, this is it, I'm home. I'm supposed to be making wine. I'm supposed to be doing it right here at Fox Run, and I know that that's crazy, but somehow this is the thing that makes sense. And so I actually did spend a year doing the responsible thing, working in the school system, trying to figure out if I could teach school so I'd be on the same schedule as my kids, but boy, that's a gift, and I don't have it, and I think school teachers give so much to so many people, and if you're not blessed with that gift, then you should find another career path. And for me, it was wine, and I'm lucky that it all worked out.
Awesome. So it sounds like you had like an epiphany moment.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So tell me, like, when that epiphany meets reality, what was that like? Because I'm sure you didn't just walk into the, I don't know, office at Fox Run and you're like, hey, I'm here to make wine. I know you've been waiting for me.
No, but it wasn't too far off, actually. It was just a convergence of great timing and a lot of luck. I stopped in with some out-of-town guests at Fox Run, and they had time for one winery. I said, oh, we have to go to Fox Run. We have to go there. And while we were doing our tasting, I just asked the person behind the bar if they ever accepted volunteers, if I could come in and hold a bucket, anything, if I could just see what went on during vintage and maybe get some career direction. And the person gave me the number of the winemaker, believe it or not, and I called that number. And was expecting to hear, no, of course you can't come here and make wine, but here's a path. You follow these classes and maybe in 10 years come back. And they said, well, we need somebody on our bottling line tomorrow. So if you can come in and bottle, maybe we can talk about something. And I bottled, of course, raced right in and bottled. And while I was there, the bottling line broke down and they had nothing for me to do. And later I was told that I was sent up to the lab to kind of get me out of the way while they fixed the bottling line. But that meant that I got to go up and taste a series of samples, which were laid out on a lab bench, and they were these tawny ports, something I'd never had. I was asked to make lab notes, something I'd never done. And eventually the winemaker came up and said, good news, the bottling line's repaired, you can go back to work. And I did, and at the end of the day, he came down and said, I don't know how you know how to do this, but if you have this inside of you, this ability to take wines and talk about the flavors and nuances and things like that somehow inside of you now, the rest I can teach you. And I was very, very, very fortunate to stumble across somebody who was willing to teach me everything that I needed to know in production and then send me back to school.
Nice. Mm-hmm. So give us some sense of timeline here. How long ago was this?
2005. Right before vintage. Mm-hmm.
And were you a big wine drinker at this point?
I was. I didn't know very much about wine, and I still think there's so much for me to learn about wines of the world, but I did know that I liked it, and that there were some very beautiful wines being made in the Finger Lakes, and I really wanted to be a part of it.
So, how, you know, you said that Fox Run was kind of your first choice to bring out-of-town guests. But tell us a little bit about the operation. I mean, when did they get started, and what are the type of wines that you guys work with?
Sure. Fox Run got its start as a dairy farm, actually, a very long time ago. There are buildings on the property that date before the Civil War. And in the 1980s, it was purchased by a couple who were retiring and thought it would make a great winery spot. And they very quickly came to realize that farming in any capacity is not a retirement. It's just not. It's a lot of work. And so they looked to sell the winery, and that was when Scott Osborne, who is the current owner, he and his wife now own the property as a family-owned business, which is wonderful, had been making wine out in California, and he came across cool climate Chardonnay. He tasted something made in the Finger Lakes and said, this is what I've been looking for my whole life. This is what I want to do. And so he came back from California to the Finger Lakes to make Chardonnay. He wanted that lemon, vanilla, apple flavors that we get, crisp bite of acidity and refreshment, and said, I know we can do this, and we can put it on the world scale, and people, once they are exposed to these wines, they will love them. And so he was a pioneer, one of the first to come to the region with the intention of making fine wine, and was willing to go to whatever lengths it took to achieve that dream.
And so starting a winery, obviously, is not, you know, you don't flip a switch. Like, there's some development time. Mm-hmm. How old is the vineyard now?
Well, it was planted in the early, mid-1980s, and it has grown substantially. It was just maybe 10 acres right around the family home when it was started, and it's grown to 55 acres, almost 60 acres now. And so one of the really great things about the plantings is that they were planted in a patchwork work fashion, because we didn't really know what was going to work well and where it was going to grow well. And so we have really varied soils on our property because of a glaciation that happened. There's bedrock, there's deep fertile soil, there are places where we have great sun exposure and places where things tend to be a little bit more drought stressed. And so from year to year, the plantings in these different soils give us very different results. And which planting will be the most successful in a given year, we don't know, because the weather is so changing. And it's been a great learning experience to see which of these plantings, which blocks produce the best varieties, which ones have been the most successful, which are the most expressive of their site and vintage. Riesling is always stellar, always, no matter what the conditions. Even when we're on the verge of having a vineyard collapse, Riesling is spectacular. Lemberger is another grape. It's a red grape, and it comes from Europe, and it is called Blaufränkisch some places, and Lemberger and Kekfränkisch are the most common names for it, but it has maybe 30 or 40 different other names because it's grown so many places. It does beautifully in the Finger Lakes, where a lot of grapes struggle to ripen. This grape ripens every year. Where a lot of grapes are susceptible to disease pressure, this grape holds on. It's got great airflow through it, long clusters that are loose, and the air flows through it, so we don't have to worry so much about rot, which is something that in a humid environment can be a big problem. It's got phenomenal flavors. It's blackberries and black pepper predominantly. It's one of those wines that a person can smell, and somebody who has never identified a single flavor in a wine goes, oh my God, I get it. It's pepper. I can see it. I know what to do with this. It can go with a steak, anything on the grill. It goes with lentils, anything smoky. And it's been a tremendous eye-opener for a lot of people about reds from the Finger Lakes. And it's, in fact, our very biggest seller in New York.
Awesome. Yeah. I know we're going to try some wines in the second half of the show. Is that going to be in the mix?
I believe it is.
Excellent. Give us a sense, how does Fox Run, like, in size and production compare to other wineries in the region? Are you a relatively average, you know, size and production model, or, you know, kind of bigger or smaller?
We're on the upper edge of boutique winemaking. We make about 15 to 20,000 cases in a given year, depending on what the yields turn out to be, which makes us large-ish in terms of Finger Lakes wine producers, but very small in terms of world wines. So often, if we'll produce something with a couple hundred cases, sometimes even less. We had one wine we released, which was only a 22 case production. So we're able to do a real range of different kinds of wines.
Nice. And for folks who are down here in the city, where should they be looking for your wines?
Oh, boy. A lot of these wines can be found in restaurants. I know Terroir has carried a lot of our Rieslings, and so has Seersucker and Astor Wines and
Whole Foods.
Oh, Whole Foods. Okay, great. Our sponsor for the show. We picked good this time. I think also if folks are interested in learning more about the vineyard at, you know, probably not now, but maybe after the interview, you can definitely visit their website, foxrunvineyards.com, for more info. So let's maybe jump back to your story. Curious about the garlic festival at the winery. What's that?
It is an enormously fun event packed with people and music and of all different sorts. Music and food, locally grown garlic is how it got started. Tents and small craft vendors come. But there is some really great food being made, and we have guest chefs who come and do food demonstrations, and of course they're wine tasting all day long and wine demos. It's just a marvelous event.
And I think Kathleen was pointing that out when we were talking before the show. Nothing quite like garlic and wine to get us in, right?
Yeah, I was a little curious. What kinds of foods and pairings come up there?
Well, when garlic is incorporated into a dish, it's very easy to pair with wine. What's very tough is when you have phenomenal garlic vendors with these snappy, hot, spicy bulbs of garlic. I don't recommend eating slices of raw garlic and then, say, trying to drink red wine. It definitely makes the tannins overpowering and the alcohol much too hot, and it will skew your experience into a very negative direction. But there, when it is incorporated into food, it pairs beautifully, especially with a wine that either has some acid, like the Riesling, or a Chardonnay, or Blanc de Blanc, or when it's paired with something with some spice and a little bit of weight, like a Limburger.
So you showed up at the garlic festival, then you showed up to Bottle, right? And they were like, okay, we're going to work with you. Mm-hmm. You know, give us some broad strokes. How was your training developed? Did you do everything within the vineyard and kind of learn on the job, or was it a mix of professional development from outside resources? I mean, how do you become a winemaker?
Well, the Finger Lakes is a very special area because there is so much collaboration that happens there, maybe more so than any place I've ever seen in the world, and certainly within an industry like winemaking, which can be so competitive. I was trained primarily by Peter Bell, who is the head winemaker at Fox Run, and also by the other winemakers in the region. Peter pioneered a system of collaboration, and that meant that with Scott's approval, Peter was able to tell everybody everything we were doing. No secrets. No secrets because they came on at a time where the region was known primarily for sweet hybrid or native variety wines that appealed largely to the local wine consumer and tourists, which is fun and fine. It's good. It's got a place, but they also recognize the potential for very high quality, brilliant vinifera wines. And the way to make people aware of the fact that we can make these kinds of wines, we all had to make good wine. Bad winemaking was not going to help anybody in the region. If we were known, if somebody came to visit and tasted a wine and said, boy, that is really flawed. The best way to make the region grow in terms of quality produced and quality recognition were to share everything. So winemakers get together twice a month at Fox Run, and now other places as well. Other wineries have picked up the model. And we come together from all different wineries, and we bring wines and a thick skin and a brown paper bag. And those wines get poured. We'll pick a topic, whether it's wines in progress or maybe a particular region in the world, and we'll slot in some of our wines to see what do we think when we don't know what it is that we're tasting? How are we doing? Where can we improve? And when somebody's doing something that's not ideal, we talk about it and say, okay, well, if that's not what you wanted to say with your wine, how can we change that? And if somebody's doing something exceptional, they tell us what they're doing. We share that so that we all can improve. And I learned a lot from that. I also did go back to school. I went to the community college for chemistry, and then UC Davis Online has a great program for winemakers.
Wow, awesome. Mm-hmm. So in that spirit of collaboration, that is what brings you to the city, right? The New York Drinks New York, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's more information about amazing winemakers here in New York that you can find at newyorkdrinksnewyork.com. We are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to tuck into a little bit of a wine tasting. So hang tight.
This one's called More Life by Tom Cruise on heritageradionetwork.org. Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
We are back. You are tuned into the Heritage Radio Network, and we are talking New York State wines. We're in studio with Tricia Renshaw of Fox Run Vineyards, and I'm joined by my co-host Kathleen Cherry, and we're gonna taste some wines. But Kathleen, I think we need to set the stage a little bit. You know, I enjoy wine, but I'm by no means a wine aficionado. What's your wine background?
Chardonnays. Basically, I stick to that. My knowledge in wine is very, very limited.
Well, that's
so
great.
Like when we're tasting it, help me out.
I will. I'm glad that you're drinking Chardonnay. It's a grape we're all very fond of. The most popular white wine out there, so you're not alone. But there is an entire world of wine out there, and I'd like to open up your mind to trying some other things today, because I did not bring you a Chardonnay on purpose. I brought you some other things, and we love Chardonnay too, don't get me wrong, but there's so much out there to drink, and often it's just we don't know what to ask for, because you know where your comfort zone lies. So maybe you'll see something here today that will encourage you to try a few things.
Awesome. What are we going to start with?
The wine that is in front of you is a rosé. So pink wine is very confusing to a lot of customers. A lot of consumers look at pink and think, I don't know what I'm going to get. Is this going to be sweet and fruity? Or is it going to be dry? Because sometimes it is. And when you see the word rosé, sometimes now New World producers will put the word dry with the word rosé. So you know there's no sugar there, or very, very little. So little that you can't really perceive it. We want it to be refreshing, and it can be made in several different styles. The one that you have in front of you is actually made out of red grapes. And it is the very palest pink, isn't it? A little salmon-y. And the way that we achieve that color out of red grapes is by crushing them and pressing them right away like you would make a white wine. And so we're going to go after a white wine body here, acidity and freshness. We're also going to take some of the grapes and we're going to crush them and leave them in a bin for a couple of hours. And all of the color that's in the skins, which is where all the red color resides, is going to leach into the juice, and the tannins, which are also in the skins, are going to leach into the juice, and that means you won't have a purely white wine mouthfeel. We're aiming for something somewhere in between the two. We want freshness from white wine. We also want a little bit of weight and body that you get from a red wine, but makes a wine that's drinkable and weighty that goes with so many different ranges of food. Anything that's hot and spicy, something that you'd want in the summertime, it's perfect with a salad. If you're going to grill it and put an avocado with it, you can have it with a rosé. Shrimp, seafood, all those kinds of things. Rosé is brilliant.
Nice. I mean, it's like definitely jumping out at me. It's like super kind of like bright. And
yeah, I'm getting the fresh notes from it too.
Good.
Am I getting a little oakiness?
No. You might be associating the flavors that you're getting with oakiness because those tannins usually come from oak, but they also come from the red grape, and that's where that connection comes from. Your brain's automatically going to associate those things and going to stick a little bit of that in there.
So, someone who's like just starting to talk about wine and looking to kind of build their vocabulary, can you give us, you know, so if, say I'm like, Tricia, this is the best wine I've ever had, and when I go out to dinner tonight, I want to tell the sommelier what would I tell them to like kind of convey what I'm tasting here? When they're like, well, what kind of wines do you like?
Always a hard question. It's a very tricky question. What do you like? Well, so many of us really don't know. We know what we don't like. But what you do like is tends to be so much broader. If you tell them you want a rosé, they will guide you to something beautiful. And they come from all around the world. They're made with many different grapes. Some of them are made with a white wine blended with a red wine. Sometimes they're bled off, meaning that if you are having a fermentation and you've got wine, making wine on the skin, sometimes a winemaker will draw off some of that fermenting juice. And sometimes you'll do it like we do, where you're crushing and pressing and then doing a little skin contacting and blending. But the result is very similar, very similar. If you want something that's sweeter, I would specify a blush or something. Tell them you're looking for a sweetness. Otherwise, dry rosé will net you something like this.
And mm-hmm. now I notice this is a little chilled. Should mm-hmm. rosé always be served cool, cold?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a rosé is always best cold. It's funny, of course, let your own taste be your guide, as in anything, but rosé should be served like a white wine on the cooler side, especially when it's hot out. Put it in a carafe and watch the condensation beat up on the outside, and you're already going to be cooled before you even get a sip.
As I say, the condensation never has much of a chance to develop. Well, I had like another question with regards to, you know, rosé in particular to New York State. Mm-hmm. I mean, are there flavor notes or things that you see that are more distinctive to this region that you might set rosés from New York State aside, you know, apart from rosés produced in other parts of the world?
I don't know if there's so much apart from other places in the world, because we do use grape varieties that are used in other places. There are flavors that are characteristic of the different grapes that are used, and quite often they will be listed somewhere on the label. For example, we use Lemberger. And when you make a table wine, a fully fermented wine on the skins out of Lemberger, you will end up with these black cherry, blackberry, and black pepper flavors. If you crush and press and make a rosé, only the berry flavors and floral flavors show up. That black pepper takes some time to develop, and so it's not going to show up in a rosé. If you're drinking a rosé made out of Cabernet Franc, it's going to have a really bright green edge to it, and in a very nice sense, like almost like mint leaves in a lemonade, that kind of reaction. Yeah, it's quite beautiful. And many people are using that variety. Other places in the world will use other grapes, and so there will be characteristics of the grape in the finished wine. So try a range of them.
Cool. So what's up next?
Up next is exactly, I guess I'm getting some choices. Let's try the Lemberger itself, because this is going to show you a really nice contrast between what happens with the same grapes. If you crush and press, you get this very beautiful pale pink wine. Look what you've got in your glass now. It is as dark a red wine as you can imagine.
Garnet.
And if you want to give that a swirl, smell that. Put it up to your face and take a minute to smell that. Black pepper just leaps right out of the glass. The flavor chemists recently named that flavor chemical. They were looking at black peppercorns and said, this is the, you know, they draw out this really pretty diagram and say, this is what gives black pepper its characteristic flavor. Then they looked and found it in Lemberger, and they also found it in Syrah. So these wines have some things in common, and it is this particular flavor marker, which is very recognizable. Almost everybody's able to smell it, and most people can smell it in a very low concentration. But as I said, it doesn't show up unless you're going to ferment on the skins. That was probably a 10-day fermentation, and it brought all that black pepper into the mix. Very different from the rosé.
We're getting a thumbs up from Kathleen.
Good. I'm so glad. So maybe something else you'd order instead of a Chardonnay this time.
Yeah, definitely. I'm trying to get into the reds.
Good.
This is like entry-level red. I don't know. I'm getting a little pineapple on the nose. Is that like...
You are asking a really complex question, because what you're going to smell is determined by your neurobiology and by your experiences. There are thousands of places in your brain that you're going to be able to register aromas, and you're only going to get a handful of them, hundreds of potential out of thousands of potential sites. So what each of us is able to smell is going to be different just based on who we are, and those things may not actually change with experience, so throughout your life those things will change. So there's no sense in arguing about whether or not you're tasting pineapple. So if you're tasting pineapple, you can just let us know that that's the experience you're having, and that's perfect.
Nice. And have you found, like, you know, now that you're a wine professional, has your palate, has your sense, I mean, obviously your vocabulary has increased, and you know what's happening at, you know, from a molecular level, or what you kind of should or shouldn't be seeing. But just your real kind of like raw experience, has that shifted in a way that you recognize where like, oh, I remember tasting this wine, you know, a decade ago, and now I just I just taste it different because of what I've been doing?
Absolutely. And we're continually evolving. And like any time you make a decision about something that you like, you have the opportunity to have experiences, whether it's sitting around casually with friends or whether it's in a professional setting, of being exposed to something, a different idea, a different... Somebody says, oh, you know, I taste pineapple. I remember tasting a bunch of wines in our winemakers group, and we were around the board. We just didn't like it until one woman said, I really like this wine. And this, the reason I like this wine is because I'm tasting lavender, and it reminds me of home, and it's so beautiful. And there was this weird flavor that I couldn't put my finger on. Once I saw it as lavender, it was beautiful, and then I could love it too. So it's just tasting wine with other people often opens you up to things that you might not have liked so much to begin with. And then alternatively, sometimes something that you latch onto in the beginning of your wine drinking, because you can identify it, or you say, oh, you know, this is something that I can taste, I can identify, whether it's a lot of oak in a wine, then maybe over time you might not like so much oak in wine because you want to move away from where you were. We all want to grow. And that just means following a path that's going to lead you away from where you were in some regards.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming down and joining us in the studio today. It was great to get to learn a little bit more about your story and the vineyard, and even better to taste some of the wines. If folks want to find out more about your work, they can visit the website foxrunvineyards.com. If you're lucky enough to be in New York City, head over to Terroir or out to your local Whole Foods and pick up a bottle today. And as always, stay tuned in to the Heritage Radio Network. This, like all 30 of our live weekly shows, is available as a free download through iTunes. You can also find us on Stitcher Smart Radio. But we hope you'll visit the website, www.heritageradionetwork.org. If you like what you hear, definitely click that donate tab and think about becoming a member today. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.